Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we hear from market and weather expert Bruce Burnett about a recent panel discussion on how to improve ag data.
One of the most interesting areas was, using some of the precision data that we are getting now from some of the equipment.
Western producers Jeremy Symes investigates the gender gap on ag commission boards across the prairies.
They'll think about talking about how the commissions can right now diversify their boards, what they can do to get more people on board, whether that's more women.
And Ashley Robinson and Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada bring us reports from this year's Grain World Conference. All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Every farmer knows what it's like to be approached by Statistics Canada when it's doing its crop surveys. And every farmer knows how important StatsCan's numbers are. Crop prices can jump and slump if the agency comes out with something surprising. Like everything these days, StatsCan is coping with the information revolution. At a session in Winnipeg recently, its chief statistician suggested that future StatsCan data, including crop surveys, could be done in different ways. Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather Information, was actually part of the event, and he joins us now to talk about this. Hello, Bruce, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Ed.
So what was Anil Arora suggesting StatsCan could do differently?
Well, I think basically, and let's step back and look at what they do now. Right now, they do exactly what you said. They survey a number of farmers during parts of the crop year to get an assessment of what the area is of the crop, as well as what the yield potential is, especially later on in the season. And what Statistics Canada is looking at is there other data out there that they could use that would provide, I think, an added benefit that they wouldn't have to bother farmers maybe as much if they could have access to some of this data. And so that's what they're in right now, a series of meetings talking about statistics and how they can improve their process.
And what kind of data are we talking about? What could they get access to that could help flush out our idea of the crop in the field?
Well, there's a number of things that they use. Already they use the statistics September survey was not really a survey, but actually a remote sensing estimate that they came up with in terms of yield. So they're looking at ways of taking different types of data and using it as a reliable statistical indicator of how big our crops are. I think one of the most interesting areas was, using some of the precision data that we are getting now from some of the equipment. And they were thinking about getting access to that with the farmer's permission, of course, so that they could use that type of information in fairly nearly real time, especially in terms of the harvest data, to help them fine tune their estimates.
And what do you think about this?
I think it's a good idea, certainly as we go through the years here with fewer farmers and certainly busier farmers, those phone calls tend to be a bit taxing. So if there are alternate ways of getting the same type of statistical accuracy, it would be, I think, a benefit to both farmers as well as the industry. My biggest concern here is far and away about market transparency and getting data that the market would like to have in terms of knowledge of how big the crops are as quickly as possible so we don't get a lot of sudden surprises.
You were on a panel giving your thoughts on all of this, and you mentioned a few things that you thought StatsCan could do a bit better. What were some of those?
Well, I think certainly right now the survey data, we're running two surveys of crop production in the size of the crop. So we had an estimate at the end of July. Then there was this remote sensing information that came out in September. But our last report's going to be in the first week in December. And that's a long period of time for the market to go directionless or without a statistical post to to recalibrate their estimates or thoughts on what the size of the crops are. During the same type of time periods, USDA's released five production reports in terms of the various commodities they look at. And I'm not saying that we have to go to that level, but certainly I think some reliable, more consistent ways of displaying this data is needed throughout this period of time, especially from harvest onwards, that we get a better idea of what the crop's potential is or the crop actually is in terms of size.
And did you have any concerns about Aurora suggesting that they want to, as an agency, be less survey-centric, was a term you used, or rely less on surveys? Did that raise any concerns with you, or does that sound okay?
I think that there's something that we have to realize here, that the survey still provides some essential information for Stats Canada, for Statistics Canada's entire program. And I wouldn't like to see them cut back even further because we've already cut back the number of surveys that they've done to be replaced by other data that may not be quite as reliable. Certainly the remote sensing data is welcome to have that, but it does require that we have those surveys as well at the same time. So certainly the survey data I would like to see continue, as well as some being supplemented by some of these new methodologies.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Bruce.
Thanks.
Bruce Burnett is Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather Information. This is Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. The Canadian grain handling industry is going through its most dramatic period of growth in two decades. That was a big theme of the Grain World Conference in Winnipeg in mid-November, as hundreds of farmers, analysts, advisors, and members of the ag industry gathered for the first big conference of the winter. Reporter Ashley Robinson of Commodity News Service was there, and she joins me now to talk about what the industry was talking about. Hello, Ashley, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hello, Ed.
So, Ashley, how is the Canadian grain handling industry changing?
Well, it's changing a lot of different ways. So I sat in on the panel, and we're seeing a lot of different things changing in regards to the traditional grain industry shift. And so, first of all, there's a lot less elevators down in the prairies. We've gone from seeing almost 3,000 in the 1980s to less than 400 now. And that may sound like a dramatic shift, but when you're looking at how those elevators have changed, we've seen them change from being closer to different producers. They're very close to them so that we could get the grain to the elevators faster because we had a lot smaller units and stuff that we were using. As to now, we're seeing a lot of larger facilities, and that's due to a lot of things like the elevators are bigger, and we're also seeing a lot more on-farm storage, and the grain trucks are getting larger, which is making for, even though it sounds like with a lot less elevators, it might be a slower shipping time, it's actually making for a faster shipping time, because when you get a lot larger stuff, you can send out a lot of stuff faster. And that's, of course, grain that we're talking about. So this is actually making for a faster shipping process than we have seen in history.
And what is one of these grain trains of the future going to look like as it picks up stuff on the prairies, rails it out to Vancouver, and then turns around and comes back? What's that going to be like?
Well, right now there's a lot of grain cars in the country. We have 2,300 owned by the federal government. And in the panel, they're saying that they aren't really expecting the government to want to replace those cars. So instead, we're going to see a lot more privately owned cars in the future. And those privately owned cars are going to be way nicer than what we're seeing on the tracks right now. So they're going to be a higher capacity, shorter car. And G3, who was talking during the panel, was saying that with these new cars and stuff, we're going to see 135 to 150 car range that for a train, and that they'll be able to haul 20% more grain. And also, G3 had a lot to talk about because they're constructing a new port right now in Vancouver, which is going to cut down shipping time a lot. So right now, with the current technologies that we have, the the system has been, the cycle has been cut down from 20 days to 14. But once G3 gets its new terminal down, they said they'll be able to cut their cycle time down to 7 days.
Yeah, and some of these trains, I think they were saying were a mile and a half long. That's a pretty big train. That's a lot of grain.
Yeah, definitely.
And when I was listening to the presentation, I noticed that David Shednovac of CN was noting that even though sort of officially or on paper, it looks like a lot of grain still would sort of have a bias towards flowing towards Thunder Bay from anywhere like Saskatoon or Swift Current east. In fact, that's really not happening. Almost all the grain wants to flow west these days. Is that something you noticed too?
Yeah, definitely. They had a lot of those charts up there and stuff, and there's a lot of lines and stuff, but you notice a lot of those lines now are beginning to point towards that Vancouver port, where before we saw them point towards a lot of different spots, but it's definitely beginning to focus. Also, I don't know if it was there or I'd read an article and stuff about it, that even though right now we're hearing a lot about there being holdups and stuff with shipping grain and stuff this year, we also saw a lot of, there was increased outputs from other industries that use the rail industry, such as potash and stuff. So we weren't really seeing, as we were saying, the future is going to be faster grain shipments, but there's also a lot of people that use those railways.
And I think you were also covering the discussion and panel about how cereal grains crops are probably going to change and evolve in the future. What are the interesting and, I guess, unusual developments we're probably going to see coming out of the companies in the future?
Well, there was a lot of talk at that when I was about the durum production, and this isn't really that surprising considering that we had a really dry summer here in Western Canada. But the producers should be worried heading into next year. Durum production will be threatened if we don't get more moisture in time for seeding. This year's crop had clung on to previous year's moisture and that was still in the ground, and it made for a decent crop. But heading into next year, we won't have that subsoil moisture. As well, Tom Otsby with Englehart Commodities mentioned during the panel, globally there are large stockpiles of wheat which will put pressure on the market. So heading into next year, it's going to be a toss-up on how Canadian durum fares.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Ashley.
Okay, thank you so much.
Ashley Robinson is a reporter with Commodity News Service. This is Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Dave Sims of Commodity News Service was also at Grain World. He joins us now to talk about the conference. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Ed.
Before we talk about what you heard there, can you give me your impressions of Grain World this year? You and I have both covered this conference quite a few times. I've covered it all the way back to 2002. And to me, it seems to have had a miraculous resurrection.
Yeah, no, I think you're bang on with that assessment. I mean, this year, there seemed to be even more enthusiasm than normal. I think it was, you know, people kind of realized what they lost when it was gone for, I guess, a year and three quarters was the length of time between the last one. So, you know, I mean, also, I think attendance was up because it was in a bigger venue this year. And I mean, it was packed. And, you know, there are people from all over Europe and the U.S. and all parts of Canada. And, yeah, like, I think people like being in the know, and they don't want to feel like they're being left behind. So, no, there definitely seemed to be a real appetite for the conference and the speakers. So, yeah, I was very impressed by the enthusiasm and the chatter around it.
Yeah, it really seemed to be dying for a while in the sort of post-CWB world. As that was wound down, the conference seemed to slowly weaken. But, boy, this year there's a lot of energy there.
Yeah, and we had different speakers too, so it you know, I had a little different feel to it, but no, I thought it was good.
So Ashley got to cover an exciting discussion about the evolution of the prairie grain industry. You got to cover a couple of sessions that provided a bit more of a challenging outlook for a key Canadian market, being China. What do we maybe need to do to dial down our expectations for Canadian canola sales to China?
Well, I mean, I think one concern I heard popping up there, especially at one of the presentations, was China's seemingly insatiable demand for high-protein oil seeds. And, I mean, canola's got protein in it, but it doesn't have as much as soybeans. And, you know, when you look at the numbers, like I think China is forecast to have around 100 million tons of soybeans, you know, imported into the country in 2017-18 from the last projections from USDA. And canola, I mean, you would expect that we'd be less than that, but I mean, it's just 4 million to 4.4 at the top. So, you know, when you look at that difference, that kind of, you know, it's sort of leading to people asking questions, why are we behind? And I mean, one answer, of course, is canola is pretty well always at a premium compared to soybeans and palm oil. So, I mean, if it's more expensive, yeah, it's going to be a tougher sell. But apparently, the you know, China is focusing very highly on getting higher percentages of protein into their supply system. And canola is paying the price a bit here.
That's a bit of a disappointment, I think, to a lot of people here who thought China was going to be nothing but grow.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just shaping up. Like, they are grow, but they have a clear preference. They would rather crush beans right now than canola. And I mean, one way around that is if you can offer discounts. So, I mean, China can always be persuaded to accept canola, but, you know, then you start getting into discounts and the luster of the canola export starts to die down for Canada.
I hate to turn you into a downer Dave on China, but you were also covering a session on Canadian flax market prospects in China, and especially since our problems with European Union trade barriers, China's been a big thing for our industry and keeping it alive. But I believe you were covering somebody who was saying that we can't necessarily also bank on growth in Chinese demand for flax in a permanent way.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess Canada's had China almost all to itself for flax for a while now, but there definitely is some worries about the so-called Chinese Silk Road, and that is, of course, China's desire to connect itself with Europe and all sections of Asia, and the government there is committed, the Chinese government is committed to spending over $1 trillion. It'll probably be more like two or something when they're finished. And that is drilling through mountains, clearing jungle, constructing hundreds of bridges, and of course, one area they want to get a firmer link to is Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan is a main grower of flax in the world. So it certainly leads some to think, well, you know, if and when that road link is established, Kazakhstan is a lot closer to China than Canada. So, I mean, yeah, it could be, that could be a problem for Canada when and if it happens. But, I mean, also, I mean, flax is facing some challenges like other crops closer to home, too, with being squeezed out by canola and some of the other more lucrative crops right now. So, I mean, yeah, for flax growers, they have some challenges. And this is just one more. I mean, a saving grace, of course, is, though, it's going to be quite a while before this, you know, the so-called Silk Road is constructed. But if it is, then I would suspect, you know, flax you could be facing a hard sell to China.
Yeah, it's too bad for a crop that has such a healthy oil. You can make linoleum out of it. You would think that it would not be so hard to grow and sell, but it's had its challenges, hasn't it?
Yeah, and actually you kind of mentioned there one of the, you know, ways forward, I guess. I mean, the presenter I talked to, he said value added is the way to go. You know, flooring, paint, I mean, flax seed can be used, you know, turned into linseed and that. So there's a lot of uses for it. And I mean, I suspect we'll always find some outlets for food use because it is so healthy. But yeah, I mean, China seems to be kind of the number one market for everybody because it's so big. But yeah, that could be a problem moving forward. But I'm optimistic. I think we will find kind of more enhanced value-added uses for it going forward. And as I said, we do have some time because the Silk Road is going to be quite a while to construct.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Dave.
Yeah, always fun, Ed.
Dave Sims is a reporter with Commodity News Service. I'm Ed White, your host this week on Between the Rows. There aren't a lot of women on the boards of directors of farmer organizations. Why is that? Is it a problem? What do the organizations think about that? What do women in agriculture think about that? The Western Producers Edmonton reporter, Jeremy Symes, had a look at the issue and joins us now to talk about what he found. Hello, Jeremy, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hello, Ed.
So why did you have a look at this, Jeremy?
So it was a little over a month ago, the Alberta government here made an announcement where they were saying that 50% of all their boards had gender parity, which means 50% of them were women and 50% of them were men. And this included the Alberta Agriculture Products Marketing Council. And that's the organization that oversees all of the commissions that take off checkoffs from our producers. And so that organization also had this gender parity of 50% men, 50% women. And so I thought, okay, I guess we should look into the commissions themselves. And so I did a little bit of digging, and I kind of thought, you know, there wasn't going to be a lot of women representation, but I wanted to actually find the real numbers.
So what did you find?
So what I found was that of all the commissions in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, the ones that take checkoff dollars, 12% of their board members are women, while the rest, or 88%, are men. So in other words, that's 52 women and 386 men. So I had this data, and now what I wanted to do was just kind of look into why there was low representation. I wanted to chat with some women on boards to kind of get their thoughts on it, and then just look into the boards themselves, just kind of dig deeper in terms of to see what the culture in these boards was like, what other factors might be at play in terms of why there is low representation.
And when you spoke to women, both those who were on boards and those who aren't but are interested in the issue, what did you find out from them?
So I think I'll start off by saying I really appreciate all the women who spoke to me on this article. I appreciate all the viewpoints. That being said, the viewpoints were very diverse. I don't think everyone agreed with one another. So on one side, we had lots of women saying that, yes, this is a problem in the egg industry. We need more women on our boards. And that's because they're saying, you know, women generally offer different viewpoints. And when you have these different viewpoints coming into agriculture boards, you're going to get better decisions made down the line, and that means better decisions for the egg industry as a whole. And then on the other side, there were women that were saying, no, this isn't a problem. And that's because they were saying that the right person should be hired for the right job. It shouldn't matter if the person is a man or a woman. We need qualified people to be on these boards so that best decisions can be made. Because these boards, people work lots of hours on them, and it takes a lot of work, and you need someone who will be dedicated. And so you have these two opposing sides, but I think where lots of women agreed with was that our boards, some of them are not diverse at all, and so maybe there could be more to be done to diversify agriculture boards, whether that is more women, more younger farmers, and just different farmers with different backgrounds who can offer those different experiences. Now, I'll go to the culture thing in the boards because there was also some diverse opinion on this as well. So there were some women that were saying these boards are an old boys club. They thought, you know, it is a little intimidating for women to be on these boards because they are usually comprised of men who knew each other, friends of friends, and they don't really feel like it's easy for them to get connected. On the other hand, you have some boards that some women were saying are very open. They are open to ideas from them. There is none of this old boys club mentality. And they suggested that maybe there are so few women on boards because the fact of the matter is the laws are still providing help at home, mostly taking care of children. They might be working outside the farm to help supplement the income. They might still even be farming. And, you know, they're just super busy even being on different organizations that, even though it might not be commissions that take in big bucks from producers, they are still organizations that are vital to agriculture, and they're busy with that. So overall, very different opinions, but some agreeing in some areas.
And what did you find out when you approached the different organizations?
Same thing. You know, the organizations disagreed in some areas, agreed in other areas. What I thought was interesting, though, is in terms of the organization's Young Leadership Program, which is a program that gets young farmers involved, that teaches them about good governance, teaches them how to be leaders in their communities. And it's kind of a way to prepare them to get on boards when they get older. And, you know, at the Alberta Beef Producers, in their Young Leaders Program, they don't require a gender parity, while at the Alberta Canola Producers, they do require a gender parity, basically for the same reasons. You know, the beef producers are saying, we want the right young leaders to be in this program. And then the canola producers saying, well, we want gender parity because as time moves on, we want, you know, our ag boards to reflect, you know, the future in a way. And so they feel like getting this gender parity will, you know, just have more diverse boards in the future. Anyway, when I looked at the Alberta Beef Producers Board, not the board, sorry, but the Young Leader Board, I would say about 50% of those young farmers were women anyway. So I think what we're going to see happen within the next decade is we're going to see more women be on our boards just as time goes on, because a lot of the young people right now, about half of them are women that are involved, and there's a lot more women that are involved. So I think it's just going to be a time will tell thing. In terms of the Alberta Agriculture Products Marketing Council, which again oversees all the commissions, they were really interested in this topic and interested in the fact that the numbers were so low. So what they're thinking about is they do training anyway, but as part of that training with the commissions, they'll think about talking about how the commissions can right now diversify their boards, what they can do to get more people on board, whether that's more women or just different kinds of farmers. And so, yeah, we might see some changes a little sooner than later if a lot of this training really pans out and if the commissions take it to heart.
Well, it's really interesting work you did there, Jeremy. So thank you very much for joining us today to lay it out a bit for us.
Yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate it.
Jeremy Symes is the Western Producers reporter in Edmonton. This is all we have time for this week on Between the Rows. I'm Ed White. See you next week.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.